This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents The Fifth Witness by Michael Connelly. Read by Peter Giles. This is for Dennis Wojciechowski, with many thanks. Part 1, The Magic Words. Chapter 1. Mrs. Pena looked across the seat at me and held her hands up in a beseeching manner. She spoke in a heavy accent, choosing English to make her final pitch directly to me.
"Please, you help me, Mr. Mickey?"
I looked at Rojas, who was turned around in the front seat, even though I didn't need him to translate. I then looked past Mrs. Pena, over her shoulder and through the car's window, to the home she desperately wanted to hold on to. It was a bleached pink two-bedroom house with a hard scrabble yard behind a wire fence. The concrete step to the front stoop had graffiti sprayed across it, indecipherable except for the number 13. It wasn't the address. It was a pledge of allegiance. My eyes finally came back to her. She was 44 years old and attractive in a worn sort of way. She was the single mother of three teenage boys and had not paid her mortgage in 9 months. Now the bank had foreclosed and was moving in to sell the house out from under her. The auction would take place in 3 days. It didn't matter that the house was worth little or that it sat in a gang-infested neighborhood in South L.A. Somebody would buy it, and Mrs. Pena would become a renter instead of an owner. That is, if the new owner didn't evict her. For years, she had relied on the protection of the Florencia 13. But times were different. No gang allegiance could help her now. She needed a lawyer. She needed me. "Tell her I will try my best," I said. "Tell her I am pretty certain I will be able to stop the auction and challenge the validity of the foreclosure. It will at least slow things down. It will give us time to work up a long-range plan, maybe get her back on her feet." I nodded and waited while Rojas translated. I had been using Rojas as my driver and interpreter ever since I had bought the advertising package on the Spanish radio stations. I felt the cell phone in my pocket vibrate. My upper thigh read this as a text message, as opposed to an actual phone call, which had a longer vibration. Either way, I ignored it. When Rojas completed the translation, I jumped in before Mrs. Pena could respond. "Tell her that she has to understand that this isn't a solution to her problems. I can delay things, and we can negotiate with her bank. But I am not promising that she won't lose the house. In fact, she's already lost the house. I'm going to get it back, but then she'll still have to face the bank." Rojas translated, making hand gestures where I had not. The truth was that Mrs. Pena would have to leave eventually. It was just a question of how far she wanted me to take it. Personal bankruptcy would tack another year onto foreclosure defense, but she didn't have to decide that now. "Now tell her that I also need to be paid for my work. Give her the schedule, $1,000 up front and the monthly payment plan."
"How much on the monthly and how long?"
I looked out at the house again. Mrs. Pena had invited me inside, but I preferred meeting in the car. This was drive-by territory, and I was in my Lincoln Town Car BPS. That stood for Ballistic Protection Series. I bought it used from the widow of a murdered enforcer with the Sinaloa cartel. There was armored plating in the doors, and the windows were constructed of three layers of laminated glass. They were bulletproof. The windows in Mrs. Pena's pink house were not. The lesson learned from the Sinaloa man was that you don't leave the car unless you have to. Mrs. Pena had explained earlier that the mortgage payments she had stopped making 9 months ago had been $700 a month. She would continue to withhold payments to the bank while I worked the case. She would have a free ride for as long as I kept the bank at bay, so there was money to be made here. "Make it $250 a month. I'll give her the cut rate plan. Make sure she knows she's getting a deal and that she can never be late with the payments. We can take a credit card if she has one with any juice on it. Just make sure it doesn't expire until at least 2012. Rojas translated, with more gestures and many more words than I had used, while I pulled my phone. The text had come from Lorna Taylor. "Call me ASAP." I'd have to get back to her after the client conference. A typical practice would have an office manager and receptionist, but I didn't have an office other than the back seat of my Lincoln. So Lorna ran the business end of things and answered the phones at the West Hollywood condo she shared with my chief investigator. My mother was Mexican-born, and I understood her native language better than I ever let on. When Mrs. Peña responded, I knew what she said, the gist of it, at least. But I let Rojas translate it all back to me anyway. She promised to go inside the house to get the $1,000 cash retainer and to dutifully make the monthly payments. To me, not the bank. I figured that if I could extend her stay in the house to a year, my take would be $4,000 total. Not bad for what was entailed. I would probably never see Mrs. Peña again. I would file a suit challenging the foreclosure and stretch things out. The chances were I wouldn't even make a court appearance. My young associate would do the courthouse legwork. Mrs. Peña would be happy, and so would I. Eventually, though, the hammer would come down. It always does. I thought I had a workable case, even though Mrs. Peña would not be a sympathetic client. Most of my clients stop making payments to the bank after losing a job or experiencing a medical catastrophe. Mrs. Peña stopped when her three sons went to jail for selling drugs and their weekly financial support abruptly ended. Not a lot of goodwill to be had with that story. But the bank had played dirty. I had looked up her file on my laptop. It was all there, a record of her being served with notices involving demands for payment and then foreclosure. Only Mrs. Peña said she had never received these notices, and I believed her. It wasn't the kind of neighborhood where process servers were known to roam freely. I suspected that the notifications had ended up in the trash, and the server had simply lied about it. If I could make that case, then I could back the bank off Mrs. Peña with the leverage it would give me. That would be my defense, that the poor woman was never given proper notice of the peril she was in. The bank took advantage of her, foreclosed on her without allowing her the opportunity to make up the arrears, and should be rebuked by the court for doing so. "Okay, we have a deal," I said. "Tell her to go in and get the money while I print out a contract and receipt. We'll get going on this today." I smiled and nodded at Mrs. Peña. Rojas translated and then jumped out of the car to go around and open her door. Once Mrs. Peña left the car, I opened the Spanish contract template on my laptop and typed in the necessary names and numbers. I sent it to the printer that sat on an electronics platform on the front passenger seat. I then went to work on the receipt for funds to be deposited into my client trust account. Everything was above board. Always. It was the best way to keep the California bar off my ass. I might have a bulletproof car, but it was the bar I most often checked for over my shoulder. It had been a rough year for Michael Holler and Associates, attorneys at law. Criminal defense had virtually dried up in the down economy. Of course, crime wasn't down. In Los Angeles, crime marched on through any economy. But the paying customers were few and far between. It seemed as though nobody had money to pay a lawyer. Consequently, the public defender's office was busting at the seams with cases and clients while guys like me were left starving. I had expenses and a 14-year-old kid in private school who talked about USC whenever the subject of colleges came up. I had to do something. And so I did what I had once held as unthinkable. I went civil. The only growth industry in the law business was foreclosure defense. I attended a few bar seminars, got up to speed on it, and started running new ads in two languages. I built a few websites and started buying the lists of foreclosure filings from the county clerk's office. That's how I got Mrs. Peña as a client. Direct mail. Her name was on the list, and I had sent her a letter, in Spanish, offering my services. She told me that my letter happened to be the first indication she had ever received that she was in foreclosure. The saying goes that if you build it, they will come. It was true. I was getting more work than I could handle. 6 more appointments after Mrs. Peña today, and had even hired an actual associate to Michael Holler and Associates for the first time ever. The national epidemic of real estate foreclosure was slowing, but by no means abating. In Los Angeles County, I could be feeding at the trough for years to come. The cases only went for $4,000 or $5,000 a pop, but this was a quantity over quality period in my professional life. I currently had more than 90 foreclosure clients on my docket. No doubt my kid could start planning on USC. Hell, she could start thinking about staying for a master's degree. There were those who believed I was part of the problem, that I was merely helping the deadbeats game the system while delaying the economic recovery of the whole. That description fits some of my clients for sure, but I viewed most of them as repeat victims, initially scammed with the American dream of home ownership when lured into mortgages they had no business even qualifying for, and then victimized again when the bubble burst and unscrupulous lenders ran roughshod over them in the subsequent foreclosure frenzy. Most of these once proud homeowners didn't stand a chance under California's streamlined foreclosure regulations. A bank didn't even need a judge's approval to take away someone's house. The great financial minds thought this was the way to go. Just keep it moving. The sooner the crisis hit bottom, the sooner the recovery would begin. I say tell that to Mrs. Pena. There was a theory out there that this was all part of a conspiracy among the top banks in the country to undermine property laws, sabotage the judicial system, and create a perpetually cycling foreclosure industry that had them profiting from both ends of the process. Me, I wasn't exactly buying into that. But during my short time in this area of the law, I had seen enough predatory and unethical acts by so-called legitimate businessmen to make me miss good old-fashioned criminal law. Rojas was waiting outside the car for Mrs. Pena to return with the money. I checked my watch and noted we were running late on my next appointment, a commercial foreclosure over in Compton. I tried to bunch my new client consultations geographically to save time and gas and mileage on the car. Today I worked the South End. Tomorrow I would hit East LA. 2 days a week I was in the car, signing up new clients. The rest of the time, I worked the cases. "Let's go, Mrs. Pena," I said. "We gotta roll." I decided to use the waiting time to call Lorna. 3 months earlier, I had started blocking the ID on my phone. I never did that when I practiced criminal, but in my brave new world of foreclosure defense, I usually didn't want people having my direct number, and that included the lender attorneys as well as my own clients.
"Law offices of Michael Haller and Associates," Lorna said when she picked up.
"How can I..." "It's me. What's up?"
"Mickey, you have to get over to Van Nuys Division right away."
There was a strong urgency in her voice. Van Nuys Division was the LAPD's central command for operations in the sprawling San Fernando Valley, on the north side of the city. "I'm working the South End today. What's going on?"
"They have Lisa Trammell there. She called."
Lisa Trammell was a client. In fact, my very first foreclosure client. I had kept her in her home for going on 8 months, and was confident I could take it at least another year further before we dropped the bankruptcy bomb. But she was consumed by the frustrations and inequities of her life, and could not be calmed or controlled. She'd taken to marching in front of the bank with a placard, decrying its fraudulent practices and heartless actions. That is, until the bank got a temporary restraining order against her.
"Did she violate the TRO? Are they holding her?" "Mickey, they're holding her for murder."
That wasn't what I was expecting to hear. "Murder? Who's the victim?"
"She said they're charging her with killing Mitchell Bondurant."
That gave me another great big pause. I looked out the window and saw Mrs. Pena coming out through her front door. She held a wad of cash in her hand. "All right. Get on the phone and reschedule the rest of today's appointments. And tell Cisco to head up to Van Nuys. I'll meet him there."
"You got it. Do you want Bullocks to take the afternoon appointments?"
Bullocks was what we called Jennifer Aronson, the associate I had hired out of Southwestern, a law school housed in the old Bullocks department store building on Wilshire. "No, I don't want her doing intake. Just reschedule them. And listen, I think I have the Trammell file with me, but you have the call list. Track down her sister. Lisa's got a kid. He's probably in school, and somebody's going to have to take him if Lisa can't." We made every client fill out an extensive contact list because sometimes it was hard to find them for court hearings and to get them to pay for my work.
"I'll start on that," Lorna said. "Good luck, Mickey."
"Same to you." I closed the phone and thought about Lisa Trammell. Somehow, I wasn't surprised that she had been arrested for killing the man who was trying to take her home away from her. It's not that I had thought it would come to this, not even close. But deep down, I had known it was going to come to something. Chapter 2. I quickly took Mrs. Pena's cash and gave her a receipt. We both signed the contract, and she got a copy for her own records. I took a credit card number from her, and she promised it would withstand a $250 a month hit while I was working for her. I then thanked her, shook her hand, and had Rojas walk her back to her front door. While he did that, I popped the trunk with the remote I carried and got out. The Lincoln's trunk was spacious enough to hold three cardboard file boxes as well as all my office supplies. I found the Trammel file in the third box and pulled it. I also grabbed the fancy briefcase I used for police station visits. When I closed the trunk, I saw the stylized 13 spray-painted in silver on the lid's black paint. Son of a bitch. I looked around. 3 front yards down, a couple of kids were playing in the dirt, but they looked too young to be graffiti artists. The rest of the street was deserted. I was baffled. Not only had I not heard or noticed the assault on my car that had taken place while I was having a client conference inside it, but it was barely past 1, and I knew most gangbangers didn't get up and embrace the day and all its possibilities until late afternoon. They were night creatures. I headed back to my open door with the file. I noticed Rojas was standing at the front stoop, chatting with Mrs. Pena. I whistled and signaled him back to the car. We had to get going. I got in. Message received. Rojas trotted back to the car and jumped in himself. "Compton?" he asked. "No, change of plans. We've got to get up to Van Nuys fast." "Okay, boss." He pulled away from the curb and started making his way back to the 110 freeway. There was no direct freeway route to Van Nuys. We would have to take the 110 into downtown where we'd pick up the 101 north. We couldn't have been starting off from a worse position in the city. "What was she saying at the front door?" I asked Rojas.
"She was asking about you."
"What do you mean?"
"She said you look like you shouldn't need a translator, you know?"
I nodded. I got that a lot. My mother's genes made me look more south of the border than north.
"She also wanted to know if you were married, boss. I told her you were. But if you want to circle back and tap that, it'll be there. She probably wanted a discount on the fees, though."
"Thanks, Rojas," I said dryly. "She already got a discount, but I'll keep it in mind." Before opening the file, I scrolled through the contacts list on my phone. I was looking for the name of someone in the Van Nuys detective squad who might share some information with me. But there was nobody. I was going in blind on a murder case. Not a good starting point, either. I closed the phone and put it into its charger, then opened the file. Lisa Trammell had become my client after responding to the generic letter I sent to the owners of all homes in foreclosure. I assumed I wasn't the only lawyer in Los Angeles who did this, but for some reason, Lisa answered my letter and not theirs. As an attorney in private practice, you get to choose your own clients most of the time. Sometimes you choose wrong. Lisa was one of those times with me. I was eager to start the new line of work. I was looking for clients who were in jams or who had been taken advantage of. People who were too naive to know their rights or options. I was looking for underdogs and thought I had found one in Lisa. No doubt she fit the bill. She was losing her house because of a set of circumstances that had fallen like dominoes out of her control. And her lender had turned her case over to a foreclosure mill that had cut corners and even violated the rules. I signed Lisa up, put her on the credit card plan, and started to fight her fight. It was a good case, and I was excited. It was only after this that Lisa became a nuisance client. Lisa Trammell was 35 years old. She was the married mother of a 9-year-old boy named Tyler, and their house was on Melba in Woodland Hills. At the time she and her husband Jeffrey bought the house in 2005, Lisa taught social studies at Grant High, while Jeffrey sold BMWs at the dealership in Calabasas. Their 3-bedroom house carried a $750,000 mortgage against an appraised value of $900,000. The market was strong then, and mortgages were plentiful and easy to get. They used an independent mortgage broker who shopped their file around, and got them into a low-interest loan that carried a balloon payment at the 5-year mark. The loan was then folded into an investment block of mortgages and reassigned twice before finding its permanent home at Westland Financial, a subsidiary of Westland National, the Los Angeles-based bank headquartered in Sherman Oaks. All was well and good for the family of three until Jeff Trammell decided he didn't want to be a husband and father anymore. A few months before the $750,000 note on the house was due, Jeff took off, leaving his BMW M3 demo in the parking lot at Union Station and Lisa holding the balloon. Down to a single income and a child to care for, Lisa looked at the reality of her situation and made choices. By now, the economy had stalled out like a plane lumbering into the sky without enough airspeed. Given her teacher's income, no institution was going to refinance the balloon. She stopped making payments on the loan and ignored all communications from the bank. When the note came due, the property went into foreclosure, and that was when I came onto the scene. I sent Jeff and Lisa a letter, not realizing Jeff was no longer in the picture. Lisa answered it. I define a nuisance client as one who does not understand the bounds of our relationship, even after I clearly and sometimes repeatedly delineate them. Lisa came to me with her first notice of foreclosure. I took the case and told her to sit back and wait while I went to work. But Lisa couldn't sit back. She couldn't wait. She called me every day. After I filed a lawsuit putting the foreclosure before a judge, she showed up at court for routine filings and continuances. She had to be there, and she had to know every move I made, see every letter I sent, and be summarized on every call I received. She often called me and yelled when she perceived that I was not giving her case my fullest attention. I began to understand why her husband had hightailed it. He had to get away from her. I began to wonder about Lisa's mental health and suspected a bipolar affliction. The incessant calls and activities were cyclical. There were weeks when I heard nothing, alternating with weeks where she would call daily and repeatedly until she got me on the line. 3 months into the case, she told me she had lost her job with the LA County School District because of unexcused absences. It was then that she talked about seeking damages from the bank that was foreclosing on her home. A sense of entitlement moved into the discourse. The bank was responsible for everything: the abandonment by her husband, the loss of her job, the taking of her home. I made a mistake in revealing to her some of my case intelligence and strategy. I did it to appease her, to get her off the line. Our examination of the loan record had turned up inconsistencies and issues in the mortgage's repeated reassignment to various holding companies. There were indications of fraud that I thought I could use to swing leverage to Lisa's side when it came time to negotiate an out. But the information only galvanized Lisa's belief in her victimization at the hands of the bank. Never did she acknowledge the fact that she had signed for a loan and was obligated to repay it. She saw the bank only as the source of her woes. The first thing she did was register a website. She used www.californiaforeclosurefighters.com to launch an organization called Foreclosure Litigants Against Greed. It worked better as an acronym, FLAG. She effectively made use of the American flag on her protest signs, the message being that fighting foreclosure was as American as apple pie. She then took to marching in front of Westland's corporate headquarters on Ventura Boulevard, sometimes by herself, sometimes with her young son, and sometimes with people she had attracted to the cause. She carried signs that decried the bank's involvement in illegal foreclosures and in putting families out of their homes and onto the streets. Lisa was quick to alert local media outlets to her activities. She got on TV repeatedly and was always ready with a soundbite that gave voice to people in her situation, casting them as victims of the foreclosure epidemic, not garden variety deadbeats. I had noticed that on Channel 5, she had even become part of the stock footage thrown up on the screen whenever there was an update on nationwide foreclosure issues or statistics. California was the third leading state in the country for foreclosures, and Los Angeles was the hotbed. As these facts were reported, there would be Lisa and her group on the screen carrying their signs, Don't take my home. Stop illegal foreclosure now. Alleging that her protests were illegal gatherings that impeded traffic and endangered pedestrians, Westland sought and received a restraining order that kept Lisa 100 yards from any bank facility and its employees. Undaunted, she took her signs and her fellow protesters to the county courthouse, where foreclosures were fought every day. Mitchell Bondurant was a senior vice president at Westland. He headed up the mortgage loan division. His name was on the loan documents relating to Lisa Trammell's house. As such, his name was on all of my filings. I had also written him a letter, outlining what I described as indications of fraudulent practices by the foreclosure mill Westland had contracted with to carry out the dirty work of taking the homes and other properties of their default customers. Lisa was entitled to see all documents arising from her case. She was copied on the letter and everything else. Despite being the human face of the effort to take her home away, Bondurant remained above the fray, hiding behind the bank's legal team. He never responded to my letter, and I never met him. I had no knowledge that Lisa Trammell had ever met or spoken with him either. But now, he was dead, and the police had Lisa in custody. We exited the 101 at Van Nuys Boulevard and headed north. The Civic Center was a plaza, surrounded by two courthouses, a library, City Hall North, and the Valley Bureau Police Complex, which included the Van Nuys Division. Various other government agencies and buildings were clustered around the main grouping. Parking was always a problem, but it wasn't my worry. I pulled my phone and called my investigator, Dennis Wojciechowski. Cisco, it's me. You close? In his early years, Wojciechowski was associated with the Road Saints Motorcycle Club, but there was already a member named Dennis. Nobody could pronounce Wojciechowski's last name, so they called him the Cisco Kid because of his dark looks and mustache. The mustache was now gone, but the name had stuck.
Already here. I'll meet you on the bench by the front stairs to the PD.
I'll be there in 5. Have you talked to anyone yet? I've got nothing.
Yeah, your old pal Curlin's running lead on this. The victim, Mitchell Bondurant, was found in the parking garage at Westland's headquarters on Ventura, about 9 this morning. He was on the ground between two cars. Not clear how long he was down, but he was dead on scene.
Do we know the cause yet?
There it gets a little hinky. At first, they put out that he'd been shot because an employee who was on another level of the garage told responding police she had heard two popping sounds, like shots. But when they examined the body on the scene, it looked like he had been beaten to death, hit with something.
Was Lisa Trammell arrested there?
No. From what I understand, she was picked up at her home in Woodland Hills. I still have some calls out, but that's about the extent of what I've got so far. Sorry, Mick.
Don't worry about it. We'll know everything soon enough. Is Curlin at the scene or with the suspect?
I was told he and his partner picked up Trammell and took her in. The partner's a female named Cynthia Longstreth. She's a D1. I've never heard of her.
I had never heard of her either, but since she was a Detective 1, my guess was that she was new to the homicide beat and paired with the veteran Curlin, a D3, to get some seasoning. I looked out the window. We were passing a BMW dealership, and it made me think of the missing husband, who had sold Beamers before pulling the plug on the marriage and disappearing. I wondered if Jeff Trammell would show up now that his wife was arrested for murder. Would he take custody of the son he had abandoned?
"You want me to get Valenzuela over here?" Cisco asked. "He's only a block away."
Fernando Valenzuela was a bail bondsman I used on Valley cases, but I knew he wouldn't be needed this time.
I'd wait on that. If they've tagged her with murder, she isn't going to make bail.
Right, yeah.
Do you know if a DA's been assigned yet?
I was thinking about my ex-wife who worked for the district attorney's office in Van Nuys. She might be a useful source of back-channel information, unless she'd been put on the case. Then there'd be a conflict of interest. It had happened before. Maggie McPherson wouldn't like that.
I've got nothing on that.
I considered what little we knew and what might be the best way to proceed. My feeling was that once the police understood what they had in this case, a murder that could draw wide attention to one of the great financial catastrophes of the time, they would quickly go to lockdown, putting a lid on all sources of information. The time to make moves was now. Sisko, I changed my mind. Don't wait for me. Go over to the scene and see what you can find out. Talk to people before they get locked down.
You sure?
Yeah. I'll handle the PD, and I'll call if I need anything.
Got it. Good luck.
You too. I closed the phone and looked to the back of my driver's head. Rojas, turn right at Delano and take me up Silmar.
No problem.
I don't know how long I'll be. I want you to drop me and then go back up Van Nuys Boulevard and find a body shop. See if they can get the paint off the back of the car. Rojas looked at me in the rearview mirror.
What paint?
Chapter 3. The Van Nuys Police Building is a four-story structure serving many purposes. It houses the Van Nuys Police Division, as well as the Valley Bureau Command Offices, and the main jail facility serving the northern part of the city. I had been here before on cases, and knew that as with most LAPD stations, large or small, there would be multiple obstacles standing between my client and me. I've always had the suspicion that officers assigned to front desk duty were chosen by cunning supervisors because of their skills in obfuscation and disinformation. If you doubt this, walk into any police station in the city and tell the desk officer who greets you that you wish to make a complaint against a police officer. See how long it takes him to find the proper form. Desk cops are usually young and dumb and unintentionally ignorant, or old and obdurate and completely deliberate in their actions. At the front desk at Van Nuys Station, I was met by an officer with the name Crimmins printed on his crisp uniform. He was a silver-haired veteran, and therefore highly accomplished when it came to the dead-eyed stare. He showed this to me when I identified myself as a defense attorney with a client waiting to see me in the detective squad. His response consisted of pursing his lips and pointing to a row of plastic chairs where I was supposed to meekly go to wait until he deemed it time to call upstairs. Guys like Crimmins are used to a cowering public. People who do exactly as he says because they are too intimidated to do anything else. I wasn't part of that public. No, that's not how this works, I said. Crimmins squinted. He hadn't been challenged by anybody all day, let alone a criminal defense attorney. Emphasis on criminal. His first move was to fire up the sarcasm responders.
Is that right?
Yes, that's right. So pick up the phone and call upstairs to Detective Curlin. Tell him Mickey Haller is on the way up, and that if I don't see my client in the next 10 minutes, I'll just walk across the plaza to the courthouse and go see Judge Mills. I paused to let the name register. I'm sure you know of Judge Roger Mills. Lucky for me, he used to be a criminal defense attorney before he got elected to the bench. He didn't like being jacked around by the police back then and doesn't like it much when he hears about it now. He'll drag both you and Curlin into court and make you explain why you were playing this same old game of stopping a citizen from exercising her constitutional rights to consult an attorney. Last time it went down like that, Judge Mills didn't like the answers he got and fined the guy who was sitting where you are $500. Crimmins looked like he'd had a hard time following my words. He was a short-sentence man, I guessed. He blinked twice and reached for the phone. I heard him confer directly with Curlin. He then hung up.
You know the way, smart guy?
I know the way. Thank you for your help, Officer Crimmins.
Catch you later.
He pointed his finger at me like it was a gun, getting the last shot in, so he could tell himself that he had handled that son-of-a-bitch lawyer. I left the desk and headed into the nearby alcove, where I knew the elevator was located. On the third floor, Detective Howard Curlin was waiting for me with a smile on his face. It wasn't a friendly smile. He looked like the cat who just ate the canary.
Have fun down there, counselor?
Oh, yeah.
Well, you're too late up here.
How's that? You booked her? He spread his hands in a phony sorry-about-that gesture.
It's funny. My partner took her out of here just before I got the call from downstairs.
Wow, what a coincidence. I still want to talk to her.
You'll have to go through the jail.
This would probably take me an extra hour of waiting, and this was why Curlin was smiling.
You sure you can't have your partner turn around and bring her down? I won't be long with her. I said it, even though I thought I was spitting into the wind. But Curlin surprised me and pulled his phone off his belt. He hit a speed dial button. It was either an elaborate hoax or he was actually doing what I asked. Curlin and I had a history. We had squared off against each other on prior cases. I had attempted on more than one occasion to destroy his credibility on the witness stand. I was never very successful at it, but the experience still made it hard to be cordial afterward. But now, he was doing me a good turn, and I wasn't sure why.
"It's me," Curlin said into the phone. "Bring her back here."
He listened for a moment.
"Because I told you to. Now bring her back."
He closed the phone without another word to his partner and looked at me.
"You owe me one, Holler. I could have hung you up for a couple of hours. In the old days, I would have."
"I know. I appreciate it." He headed back toward the squad room and signaled me to follow. He spoke casually as he walked.
"So, when she told us to call you, she said you were handling her foreclosure."
"That's right.
My sister got divorced, and now she's in a mess like that." There it was. The quid pro quo.
"You want me to talk to her?"
"No, I just want to know if it's best to fight these things or just get it over with."
The squad room looked like it was in a time warp. It was vintage 1970s with a linoleum floor, two-tone yellow walls, and gray government-issue desks with rubber stripping around the edges. Curlin remained standing while waiting for his partner to come back with my client. I pulled a card out of my pocket and handed it to him. "You're talking to a fighter, so that's my answer. I couldn't handle her case because of conflict of interest between you and me, but have her call the office and we'll get her hooked up with somebody good. Make sure she mentions your name." Curlin nodded and picked a DVD case off his desk and handed it to me.
"Might as well give you this now."
I looked at the disc. "What's this?"
"Our interview with your client. You will clearly see that we stopped talking to her as soon as she said the magic words, 'I want a lawyer.'"
"I'll be sure to check that out, Detective. You want to tell me why she's your suspect?"
"Sure. She's our suspect, and we're charging her because she did it, and she made admissions about it before asking to call a lawyer. Sorry about that, Counselor, but we played by the rules."
I held the disc up as if it were my client. "You're telling me she admitted killing Bondurant?"
"Not in so many words, but she made admissions and contradictions. I'll leave it at that."
"Did she by any chance say, in so many words, why she did it?"
"She didn't have to. The victim was in the process of taking away her house. That's plenty enough motive right there. We're as good as gold on motive."
I could have told him that he had that wrong, that I was in the process of stopping the foreclosure, but I kept my mouth shut about that. My job was to gather information here, not give it away. "What else you got, Detective?"
"Nothing that I'd care to share with you at the moment. You'll have to wait to get the rest through discovery."
"I'll do that. Has the DA been assigned yet?"
"Not that I heard."
Curlin nodded toward the back of the room, and I turned to see Lisa Trammell being walked toward the door of an interrogation room. She had the classic deer-in-the-headlights look in her eyes.
"You've got 15 minutes, Curlin said. "And that's only because I'm being nice. I figure there's no need to start a war."
"Not yet, at least," I thought, as I headed toward the interrogation room.
"Hey, wait a minute," Curlin called to my back. "I have to check the briefcase. Rules, you know."
He was referring to the leather-over-aluminum attaché case I was carrying. I could have made an argument about the search infringing on attorney-client privilege, but I wanted to talk to my client. I stepped back toward him and swung the case up onto a counter, then popped it open. All it contained was the Lisa Trammell file, a fresh legal pad, and the new contracts and power of attorney form I had printed out while driving up. I figured I needed Lisa to re-sign, since my representation was crossing from civil to criminal. Curlin gave it a quick once-over and signaled me to close it.
"Hand-tooled Italian leather," he said. "Looks like a fancy drug dealer's case. You haven't been associating with the wrong people, have you, Holler?"
He put on that canary smile again. Cop humor was truly unique in all the world. As a matter of fact, it did belong to a courier,
I said. A client. But where he was going, he wasn't going to need it anymore, so I took it in trade. You want to see the secret compartment? It's kind of a pain to open. I think I'll pass. You're good. I closed the case and headed back to the interrogation room. And it's Colombian leather, I said. Curlin's partner was waiting at the room's door. I didn't know her, but didn't bother to introduce myself. We were never going to be friendly, and I guess she would be the type to stiff me on the handshake in order to impress Curlin. She held the door open, and I stopped at the threshold. All listening and recording devices in this room are off, correct? You got it. If they're not, that would be a violation of my client's...
We know the drill.
Yeah, but sometimes you conveniently forget it, don't you?
You've got 14 minutes now, sir. You want to talk to her or keep talking to me?
Right. I went in and the door was closed behind me. It was a 9x6 room. I looked at Lisa and put a finger to my lips.
What?
She asked. That means don't say a word, Lisa, until I tell you to. Her response was to break down into a cascade of tears and a loud and long wail that tailed off into a sentence that was completely unintelligible. She was sitting at a square table with a chair opposite her. I quickly took the open chair and put my case up on the table. I knew she would be positioned to face the room's hidden camera, so I didn't bother to look around for it. I snapped open the case and pulled it close to my body, hoping that my back would act as a blind to the camera. I had to assume that Curlin and his partner were listening and watching. One more reason for his being nice. While one by one I took out the legal pad and documents with my right hand, I used the left to open the case's secret compartment. I hit the engage button on the Paquin 2000 acoustic jammer. The device emitted a low-frequency RF signal that clogged any listening device within 25 feet with electronic disinformation. If Curlin and his partner were illegally listening in, they were now hearing white noise. The case and its hidden device were almost 10 years old, and as far as I knew, the original owner was still in federal prison. I'd taken it in trade at least 7 years ago, back when drug cases were my bread and butter. I knew law enforcement was always trying to build a better mousetrap, and in 10 years, the electronic eavesdropping business must have undergone at least 2 revolutions. So I was not completely put at ease. I would still need to exercise caution in what I said, and hoped my client would as well. Lisa, we're not going to talk a whole lot here, because we don't know who may be listening. You understand?
I think so. But what is happening here? I don't understand what's happening!
Her voice had risen progressively through the sentence until she was screaming the last word. This was an emotional speaking pattern she had used several times on the phone with me when I was only handling her foreclosure. Now the stakes were higher, and I had to draw the line. None of that, Lisa, I said firmly. You do not scream at me. You understand? If I'm going to represent you on this, you do not scream at me.
Okay, sorry. But they're saying I did something I didn't do.
I know, and we're going to fight it. But no screaming. Because they had pulled her back before the booking process had begun, Lisa was still in her own clothes. She was wearing a white t-shirt with a flower pattern on the front. I saw no blood on it or anywhere else. Her face was streaked with tears, and her brown curly hair was unkempt. She was a small woman, and seemed even more so in the harsh light of the room. I need to ask you some questions, I said. Where were you when the police found you?
I was home. Why are they doing this to me?
Lisa, listen to me. You have to calm down and let me ask the questions. This is very important.
But what's going on? No one tells me anything. They said I was under arrest for murdering Mitchell Bondurant. When? How? I didn't go near that man. I didn't break the TRO.
I realized that it would have been better if I had viewed Curlin's DVD before speaking with her. But it was par for the course to come into a case at a disadvantage. Lisa, you are indeed under arrest for the murder of Mitchell Bondurant. Detective Curlin, he's the older one, told me that you made admissions to them in She shrieked and brought her hands to her face. I saw that she was cuffed at the wrists.
A new round of tears started.
I didn't admit anything! I didn't do anything!
Calm down, Lisa. That's why I'm here, to defend you. But we don't have a lot of time right now. They're giving me 10 minutes, and they're going to book you. I need to...
I'm going to jail?
I nodded reluctantly.
Well, what about bail?
It is very hard to get bail on a murder charge. And even if I could get something set, you don't have the... Another piercing wail filled the tiny room. I lost my patience.
Lisa, stop doing that! Now listen, your life is at stake here, okay? You have to calm down and listen to me. I am your attorney, and I will do my best to get you out of here, but it's going to take some time. Now listen to my questions and answer them without all the... What about my son? What about Tyler?
Someone from my office is making contact with your sister, and we will arrange for him to be with her until we can get you out. I was very careful not to introduce a hard timeline for her release. Until we can get you out. As far as I was concerned, that might be days, weeks, or even years. It might never happen, but I did not need to get specific. Lisa nodded, as if there was some relief in knowing her son would be with her sister. What about your husband? You have a contact number for him?
No. I don't know where he is, and I don't want you contacting him anyway.
Not even for your son.
Especially not for my son. My sister will take care of him.
I nodded and let it go. Now was not the time to ask about her failed marriage. Okay, calmly now. Let's talk about this morning. I have the disc from the detectives, but I want to go over this myself. You said you were home when Detective Curlin and his partner arrived. What were you doing?
I was on the computer. I was sending emails.
Okay, to who?
To my friends, to people in Flag. I was telling them that we were going to meet tomorrow at the courthouse at 10 and to bring the placards.
Okay, and when the detectives showed up, what exactly did they say?
The man did all the talking. He...
Curlin.
Yes. They came in and he asked me some things. Then he asked if I wouldn't mind coming to the station to answer questions. I said about what, and he said Mitch Bondurant. He didn't say anything about him being dead or killed. So I said yes. I thought maybe they were finally investigating him. I didn't know they were investigating me.
Well, did he tell you that you had certain rights not to speak to him and to contact a lawyer?
Yes, like on TV. He told me my rights.
When exactly?
When we were already here, when he said I was under arrest.
Did you ride with him here?
Yes.
And did you speak in the car?
No, he was on his cell phone almost the whole time. I heard him say things like, I have her with me, and like that.
Were you handcuffed?
In the car? No.
Smart, Curlin. He risked riding in the car with an uncuffed murder suspect in order to keep her suspicions down and to lull her into agreeing to speak with him. You can't build a better mousetrap than that. It would also allow the prosecution to argue that Lisa was not under arrest yet, and therefore her statements were voluntary. So you were brought here, and you agreed to talk to him?
Yes. I had no idea they were going to arrest me. I thought I was helping them with a case.
But Curlin didn't say what the case was.
No, never. Not until he said I was under arrest and that I could make a call. And that's when they handcuffed me, too.
Curlin had used some of the oldest tricks in the book, but they were still in the book because they worked. I had to watch the DVD to know exactly what Lisa had admitted to, if anything. Asking her about it while she was upset was not the best use of my limited time. As if to underscore this, there was a sudden and sharp knock on the door, followed by a muffled voice saying I had 2 minutes. Okay, I am going to work on this, Lisa. I need you to sign a couple of documents first, though. The first one is a new contract that covers criminal defense. I slid the one-page document over to her and put a pen on top of it. She started to scan it.
All these fees, she said. $150,000 for a trial? I can't pay you this. I don't have it.
That's a standard fee, and only if we go to trial.
And as far as what you can pay, that's what these other documents are for. This one gives me your power of attorney, allowing me to solicit book and movie deals, things like that, coming from the case. I have an agent I work with on this stuff. If there's a deal out there, he'll get it. The last document puts a lien on any of those funds, so that the defense gets paid first. I knew this case was going to draw attention. The foreclosure epidemic was the country's biggest ongoing financial catastrophe. There could be a book in this, maybe even a film, and I could end up getting paid. She picked up the pen and signed the documents without reading further. I took them back and put them away. Okay, Lisa, what I'm about to tell you now is the most important piece of advice in the world, so I want you to listen and then tell me you understand.
Okay.
Do not talk about this case with anyone other than me. Do not talk to detectives, jailers, other jail inmates. Don't even talk to your sister or son about it. Whenever anyone asks, and believe me, they will, you simply tell them that you cannot talk about your case.
But I didn't do anything wrong. I'm innocent. It's people who are guilty who don't talk.
I held my finger up to admonish her. No, you're wrong. And it sounds to me like you are not taking what I say seriously, Lisa.
No, I am. I am.
Then do what I'm telling you. Talk to no one. And that includes the phone in the jail. All calls are recorded, Lisa. Don't talk on the phone about your case, even to me.
Okay, okay. I got it.
If it makes you feel any better, you can answer all questions by saying, I am innocent of the charges, but on the advice of my attorney, I'm not going to talk about the case. Okay? How's that?
Good, I guess.
The door opened, and Curlin was standing there. He was giving me the squint of suspicion, which told me it was a good thing I had brought the Paquin jammer with me. I looked back at Lisa. Okay, Lisa, it gets bad before it gets good. Hang in there, and remember the golden rule. Talk to no one. I stood up. The next time you'll see me will be at first appearance, and we'll be able to talk then. Now, go with Detective Curlin. Chapter 4. The following morning, Lisa Trammell made her first appearance in Los Angeles Superior Court on charges of first-degree murder. A special circumstances count of lying in wait was added by the district attorney's office, which made her eligible for a sentence of life without parole, or even the death penalty. It was a bargaining chip for the prosecution. I could see the DA wanting this case to go away with a plea agreement before public sympathy swung behind the defendant. What better way to get that result than to hold the LWOP or the death penalty over the defendant's head? The courtroom was crowded to standing room only, with members of the media as well as flag recruits and sympathizers. Overnight, the story had grown exponentially as word spread about the police and prosecution's theory that a home foreclosure may have spawned the murder of a banker. It put a blood and guts twist on the nationwide financial plague, and that, in turn, packed the house. Lisa had calmed considerably after almost 24 hours in jail. She stood zombie-like in the custody pen, awaiting her two-minute hearing. I assured her first that her son was safe in the loving hands of her sister, and second, that Haller and Associates would do all that was possible to provide her with the best and most rigorous defense. Her immediate concern was in getting out of jail to take care of her son and to assist her legal team. Though the first appearance hearing was primarily just an official acknowledgement of the charges and the starting point of the judicial process, there would also be an opportunity to request and argue for bail. I was planning to do just that, as my general philosophy was to leave no stone unturned and no issue unargued. But I was pessimistic about the outcome. By law, bail would be set. But in reality, bail in murder cases was usually set in the millions, thereby making it unattainable for the common man. My client was an unemployed single mother with a house in foreclosure. A seven-figure bail meant Lisa wouldn't be getting out of jail. Judge Stephen Fluharty pushed the Trammell case to the top of the docket in an effort to accommodate the media. Andrea Freeman, The prosecutor assigned to the case read the charges, and the judge scheduled the arraignment for the following week. Trammell would not enter a plea until then. These routine procedures were dispensed with quickly. Fluharty was about to call a short recess so the media could pack up equipment and leave en masse when I interrupted and made a motion requesting him to set bail for my client. The second reason for doing this was to see how the prosecution responded. Every now and then I got lucky, and the prosecutor revealed evidence or strategy while arguing for a high bail amount. But Freeman was too cagey to make such a slip. She argued that Lisa Trammell was a danger to the community and should continue to be held without bail until further into the proceedings of the case. She noted that the victim of the crime was not the only individual involved in foreclosing on Lisa's place of residence, but only one link in a chain. Other people and institutions in that chain could be endangered if Trammell was set free. There was no big reveal there. It seemed obvious from the start that the prosecution would use the foreclosure as the motive for the murder of Mitchell Bondurant. Freeman had said just enough to make a convincing argument against bail, but had mentioned little about the murder case she was building. She was good, and we had faced each other on cases before. As far as I remembered, I had lost them all. When it was my turn, I argued that there was no indication, let alone evidence, that Trammell was either a danger to the community or a flight risk. Barring such evidence, the judge could not deny the defendant bail. Fluharty split his decision right down the middle, giving the defense a victory by ruling that bail should be set, and giving the prosecution a win by setting it at $2 million. The upshot was that Lisa wasn't going anywhere. She would need $2 million in collateral, or a bail bondsman. A 10% bond would cost her $200,000 in cash, and that was out of the question. She was staying in jail. The judge finally called for the recess, and that gave me a few more minutes with Lisa before she was removed by the courtroom deputies. As the media filed out, I quickly admonished her one more time to keep her mouth shut. "It's even more important now, Lisa, with all of the media on this case. They may try to get to you in jail, either directly or through other inmates or visitors you think you can trust. So remember, talk to no one. I get it." "Good. Now I also want you to know that my entire staff is meeting this afternoon to review the case and set some strategies. Can you think of anything you want brought up or discussed? Anything that can help us?" "I just have a question, and it's for you."
"What is it?"
"How come you haven't asked me if I did it?"
I saw one of the courtroom deputies enter the pen and come up behind Lisa, ready to take her back. "I don't need to ask you, Lisa," I said. "I don't need to know the answer to do my job."
"Then ours is a pitiful system. I'm not sure I can have a lawyer defending me who doesn't believe in me."
"Well, it's certainly your choice, and I'm sure there would be a line of lawyers out the door of the courthouse who would love to have this case, but nobody knows the circumstances of this case or the foreclosure like I do. And just because somebody says they believe you, it doesn't mean they really do. With me, you don't get that bullshit, Lisa. With me, it's don't ask, don't tell. And that goes both ways. Don't ask me if I believe you, and I won't tell you." I paused to see if she wanted to respond. She didn't. "So are we good? I don't want to be spinning my wheels on this if you're going to be looking for a believer to take my place."
"We're good, I guess."
"All right, then I'll be by to see you tomorrow to discuss the case and what direction we're going to be moving in. I'm hoping that my investigator will have a preliminary take on what the evidence is showing by then."
"Can I ask you a question, Mickey?"
"Of course you can."
"Could you lend me the money for the bail?"
I was not taken aback. I long ago lost track of how many clients hit me up for bail money. This might have been the highest amount so far, but I doubted it would be the last time I was asked. "I can't do that, Lisa. Number one, I don't have that kind of money. And number two, it's a conflict of interest for an attorney to provide bail for his own client. So I can't help you there. What I think you need to do is get used to the idea that you are going to be incarcerated at least through your trial. The bail is set at $2 million, and that means you would need at least $200,000 just to get a bond. It's a lot of money, Lisa, and if you had it, I'd want half of it to pay for the defense. So either way, you'd still be in jail." I smiled. but she didn't see any humor in what I was telling her.
When you put up a bond like that, do you get it back after trial?
She asked. No, that goes to the bail bondsman to cover his risk, because he'd be the one on the hook for the whole $2 million if